The LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Presentations and interviews with leading attorneys and industry professionals. On this edition, Lisa Saveri on class actions in competition and consumer protection cases, a chapter she co-authored in the book California State Antitrust and Unfair Competition Law. The opinions expressed by guests interviewed on LexisNexis Legal Podcasts do not necessarily reflect those of Reed Elsevier Incorporated, LexisNexis, subsidiary companies, shareholders, employees, or customers, and should not be considered legal advice. Lisa Saveri is of counsel to the San Francisco law firm of Saveri and Saveri Incorporated. She graduated from Stanford University with an AB degree in economics in 1978 and the University of San Francisco School of Law with a JD in 1983. In 1982, she was a legal extern to the Honorable Eugene F. Lynch, Judge of the United States District Court for the Northern District of California. She's a member of the California State Bar Antitrust and Unfair Competition Section Executive Committee, serving as first vice chair for the 2009-2010 term. Lisa, thank you very much for your time and being part of this LexisNexis Legal Podcast.
You're very welcome.
You are also the co-author of the chapter in the book California State Antitrust and Unfair Competition Law on class actions in competition and consumer protection cases. First of all, how'd you get involved in that, and what was the experience like?
Well, I serve on the executive committee of the antitrust and consumer section of the State Bar of California, and one of the projects of the executive committee a number of years ago was to do a complete revision of the what we call the Antitrust and Unfair Competition Treatise, referring it to as the treatise, and as part of that complete revision, various members of the antitrust bar were asked to rewrite certain chapters, and I and my firm, Saveri & Saveri, we specialize in plaintiff's class action antitrust litigation, and so I was one of the authors asked to rewrite the chapter on class actions.
And how'd you get into this area of the law?
Well, it's rather an interesting story. Maybe one could call it a family business. My father, Guido Saveri, was one of the early practitioners of class action antitrust litigation, and he started the firm in 1959. And one could say I grew up with antitrust law, and I went to law school, and after I graduated, I went into a firm then known as Pillsbury, Madison & Sutro, which is one of the preeminent defense law firms in the country. And after practicing there for a good number of years, I took some time off and then came back to the practice of law and decided that I wanted to pursue a plaintiff side and an antitrust practice. And so the timing was such that I was able to join my father in the practice of law, as well as my brother, who had since then graduated from law school and was practicing with him. So it is, one could say, a family business, and that's how I got into the practice of antitrust law on the plaintiff side, although at Pillsbury I did have opportunity to work on class action and antitrust cases, but from the defense perspective.
That's interesting. I bet you've seen a good number of changes over the years.
I have seen some changes, but I think what is also helpful, particularly in co-authoring a section on class actions, is that I've seen the practice from both sides. So there was a real attempt by me and my co-author, who happens to be with one of the other big defense firms in San Francisco, there was a real interest to have a very even presentation of the law. In other words, it's not one-sided or from one particular perspective, but to provide a very neutral perspective on the state of class actions under California law.
Let's get into that a little bit more if we can. What issues are better served by a class action lawsuit as opposed to an individual one?
Well, one thing that I think is noteworthy in California, and again, we're talking about cases brought under California state law, such as the Cartwright Act, which is the California antitrust statute, that California has a very, very strong policy favoring class actions and favoring consumer protection. There are numerous California Supreme Court cases that underscore the importance of the class action mechanism and the strong policy California has toward consumer protection. One very noteworthy case from, I believe it was 1986, is the state of California versus Levi Strauss. And in that opinion, the California Supreme Court said that the consumer class action is an essential tool for the protection of consumers against exploitative business practices. And that's very important. The California Supreme Court has a long-standing commitment to protecting consumers through class actions. So we have a long history of pursuing remedies for consumers in class action, unlike other states, and to a certain extent, unlike, you know, under federal law, where you're following Illinois BRIC, you do not have indirect purchasers in federal court. However, a huge change came in 2005 with the passage of the Class Action Fairness Act, which basically says that class actions, even indirect purchaser class actions, are now filed in federal court.
And the Class Action Fairness Act had a pretty significant impact on class action practice in California, right?
Well, it did. And when the Class Action Fairness Act was first passed, the question in everybody's mind is, will this have a significant effect on the substantive nature of the cases and what the result will be, or is this just moving courtrooms? Are we going to have the same results or similar results as we did in state court? We're just now sitting in a courtroom in the federal courthouse. And what has come to pass as a result of CAFA is that a lot of classes that would have been certified in state court under the California statute, Code of Civil Procedure 382, are now in federal court, and the federal Rule 23 applies. And so you have a different procedural standard that is being applied to indirect purchaser cases, with the result that cases that otherwise would have been certified in state court are now not being certified under federal procedural law. So we have the strong California public policy toward consumer protection under the laws of California, some might argue, being thwarted by the mere fact that these cases are now in federal court. So that's one, I think, significant result of CAFA. The other issue that now comes up is what law applies. Clearly, under the Erie Doctrine, as most people know, that when you're in federal court with state law-based claims, federal procedural law applies, but it's the substantive law of the state that applies. So the issue becomes, what is substantive law and what is procedural law? And those are the issues that are now coming up as cases proceed. You know, when for example, presumptions and things like that, is a presumption substantive or is it procedural? If it's procedural, federal law applies. If it's substantive, state law applies. So that is one of the issues that is now...
So is that slowing down the whole mechanism?
It's not slowing down the mechanism, but what it can lead to is a different result. And the different result would be that cases that are being scrutinized under Federal Rule 23 might not be certified, where such cases being scrutinized under California Code of Civil Procedure 382 and the California law under that section would have been certified. So we're seeing trends, you know, that cases that otherwise would have been certified in state court are now not being certified in federal courts. And today there are cases that are certified in federal court, and then there are cases that aren't certified in federal court. And it's you know, especially when you get into the cases that have been MDL'd, and you have not only direct purchasers before the federal court on a direct purchaser on their direct purchaser claims, but you also have individual putative classes under the laws of the various states, the various repealer states. So you could have 26, 27 potential state classes before the court, in addition to a federal class under federal law.
And so what's been the effect of that on the number of class action cases filed in California?
Well, you have cases that are indirect cases, class actions are basically within certain limited situations not being filed in California because you can't, because of CAFA. So they're now filed in federal courts. So you're filing your case in federal court and you're alleging a California state law claim based on, say, the Cartwright Act. But then you also have other claims being based on the laws of the other repealer states. So you now have cases pending before a federal judge that have classes based on the substantive law of each repealer state. So the court has to go through and look at the substantive laws of these various states under the umbrella of the rules, Rule 23, to determine if claims under that state's law can be certified. Yeah. And so the courts are faced with what law applies, Erie issues. But we do have cases, as a matter of fact, two that came out recently were the flat panel LCD case out of the Northern District, and the other was the SRAM opinion. So those are two recent cases that came out from the Northern District where classes were certified.
So there have been substantive developments in California.
I think what we have to distinguish is between procedural law and substantive law, because procedural law will determine whether the class is certified or not. So if you're sitting in federal court, you're going to be under the procedural standards of Federal Rule 23. If you're in state court, you're under the procedural rules of California Code of Civil Procedure 382. So that determines, depending upon where you're sitting, whether you're sitting in federal court or state court, the procedural rules of that court will apply. The other question is, what is the underlying substantive law? So if you're bringing law, if you're an indirect purchaser, Illinois BRIC, which is the federal decision, says that indirect purchasers cannot sue. Okay, so you cannot bring an indirect purchaser claim under the Sherman Act. However, in repealer states such as California, the indirect purchasers can sue under the Cartwright Act. So prior to CAFA, if you had a Cartwright Act claim and you wanted to bring a class action, you could file it in state court, and the class determination would be made under Code of Civil Procedure 382. Today, following CAFA, you cannot file that, with certain exceptions, you cannot file that case in state court. You must file your state law-based claim in federal court, which means the class determination is now being made under the procedural requirements of Federal Rule 23. So when you ask, are there substantive developments in California, the answer is yes. There was a significant case that came out a few months ago that discussed substantive law under the Cartwright Act, and that case was Clayworth versus Pfizer.
And what was that case about?
Well, Clayworth versus Pfizer was a case that tested the availability under state law of the pass-on defense. And under federal law, under Hanover Shoe, the pass-on defense is not available to the defendant. The defendant cannot argue that the plaintiff was not injured because it passed on any damage to downstream purchasers. So the question before the California Supreme Court was, is the pass-on defense available to defendants under state law? And the court came out and decided to follow the Hanover Shoe rule that under the Cartwright Act, like under federal law, there's generally no pass-on defense. There are certain exceptions in the case of a cost-plus contract or where there are multiple levels of purchasers, and if it's necessary to allocate the damages amongst those parties, then pass-on evidence can be taken to determine the allocation in order to avoid duplication of recovery. But the thing that's also important about the Clayworth versus Pfizer case is the court went through a complete analysis of pass-on law under federal law and under state law. It made an extensive examination of the California public policies towards consumer protection. It made its decisions based in part on those California public policies. And it's an important case to look at, not just from the pass-on issue, but also from a broader context of California antitrust law and how it relates to federal law, or the interplay between the California state law and federal law and how they differ. The other point that the case made, which is an important point, that based on policy considerations where you have multiple tiers of purchasers, that the overcharge is the presumptive measure of damages. In reaching that conclusion, the court went through and analyzed, you know, what are the consequences of anti-competitive conduct by a defendant or a group of defendants. and they enumerated three consequences of the anti-competitive conduct. There's the primary consequence, which is the overcharge. There's a secondary consequence, which is the pass-on. And there's a tertiary consequence to the plaintiff, which could be lost profits and sales and things like that. So in trying to determine what is the measure of damage in a Cartwright Act case, recognizing that there are these three forms of potential damage, the court made a policy determination that presumptively the measure of damage is going to be the overcharge. And that certainly is a case that anyone practicing in the antitrust arena, whether it's individual case or a class action setting, should really take a look at that case, because there's quite a bit of law in there that has a greater application than just the mere holding that there's no pass-on defense available.
And it sounds like the court really wanted to establish some guidelines for the future.
Well, I think that's true, and I think what they wanted to do is really address an issue that has been unanswered for many, many years. That issue was identified in the BWI case many years ago as an open question, and so this was the court's opportunity to address that issue.
Has there been any impact from that decision as of yet, and what do you see its effect being down the road, possibly?
Well, the case came out in July, so there really hasn't been an opportunity for it to trickle through the court system. I think that in some ways the rule is consistent with the Hanover Shoe rule in federal court, but what you will do is end up with potentially multiple parties before the court, and damage determinations are going to have to be made. And so now there's a presumption of what that damage is, but there's also the opportunity where you do have multiple tiers of purchasers that evidence of pass-on can be examined if the damages need to be allocated. As far as the future of the class action practice in California, that's somewhat of an interesting question, because some might argue that the future doesn't look too bright simply because of CAFA, that the cases can no longer, many cases can no longer be filed in state court. They under CAFA, they must be filed in federal court. That's why we're getting state law-based claims before the federal courts. They just cannot be filed in state court anymore, obviously subject to certain exceptions.
Any tips you could pass on to other practitioners in this area?
I think the treatise provides a very good overview of many areas of antitrust and consumer protection law. There are chapters that deal with many substantive areas. I think it provides a good entry point for someone who might not be familiar with antitrust law in California. From a procedural standpoint, class action standpoint, Chapter 21 provides, I think, a very comprehensive overview of class action procedure in California, not just the requirements for Section 382. In other words, how do I get a class certified? Various cases discussing issues under the statute. But there's an extensive section on CAFA, what the provisions mean, what some of the cases are that have come out under that statute. But there's also a very good section in Chapter 21 on multi-state and nationwide classes, which is what we were talking about before. What do you do when you have a case before a federal court that has been through the MDL panel, and now you might have 15, 20, 30 cases pending before one judge, or you have one case that is alleging violations of every repealer state? What do you do? What law applies? So it's a very complicated area, but I think the issues that will come up are addressed in this chapter. And then there's also some discussion about unique aspects of class certification under the UCL, and it addresses such cases as Tobacco II, which talked about standing under the UCL, and that was an important case that came out. As a matter of fact, just as the treatise was being published, we were fortunate to be able to have a discussion of Tobacco II in the treatise. And, of course, our update is coming out shortly, and one of the other issues that was addressed by the California Supreme Court in Claywith versus Pfizer was standing under the UCL. So when you take a look at the new update that will come out, you'll see what the California Supreme Court had to say on standing under the UCL.
A lot of great information. Chapter 21 is class actions in competition and consumer protection cases in the book California State Antitrust and Unfair Competition Law.
Correct. And one other thing I should point out, there is a discussion in the chapter on the CLRA. It's a fairly short chapter because it's merely talking about class certification under the CLRA, but there's also a whole separate chapter in the treatise on just the CLRA, which is the Consumer Legal Remedies Act.
Lisa Saveri, Saveri & Saveri, thank you very much. It was a pleasure having you part of this LexisNexis legal podcast.
Well, thank you, Steve, very much. It was a pleasure for me, too.
Thank you for listening to this LexisNexis legal podcast. Visit the LexisNexis communities at www.lexisnexis.com/community. The LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast, copyright 2010 by LexisNexis, a division of Reed Elsevier Incorporated. LexisNexis, I'm Steve Bursler. Thank you for listening.